Nadine Jana Black, we love on us in.
Step over class, me no father gotta cover me. No for them, who do want to see nothing good become of me. Them say them I'm a friend, me take my money, lend them money, see money.
Service providing to a provider that provides better service of internet service providing than your current provider.
As we're playing in the street. Radio stars are alive and well here on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal. Thanks for listening.
There is this thing. Do you realize what is? There is this thing. Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing on. There is this thing going on. Do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called
the news brought to you live.
Happy New Year and welcome to the January 4th, 2024 edition of No Borders Media. No Borders Media is part of CKUT's Off the Hour at 90.3 FM in Montreal, www.ckut.ca on the web. We're grassroots community radio on the island of Montreal. On today's show, we take a close look at U.S. politics as we enter 2024, which will be a presidential election year. We explore the grassroots movements fighting for justice and dignity in the USA and the disturbing continued normalization of far-right and fascist politics. To discuss these and other issues, No Borders Media speaks with It's Going Down, an online community center for anarchist, anti-fascist, autonomous, anti-capitalist, and anti-colonial movements across North America. No Borders Media will be broadcasting regularly this year, the first Thursday of every month from 5 to 6 p.m. as part of Off the Hour on CKUT, but also on our own podcasts and broadcasts. Check out No Borders Media on our social media, including Facebook, Instagram, Blue Sky, Threads, Twitter, Mastodon, for links to upcoming and previous shows. We're a no-frills show, which means my audio quality during this upcoming interview isn't the best, but that's something we'll improve in 2024. Let's go now to our extended, almost one-hour discussion with It's Going Down about the upcoming year in U.S. politics.
I'm on the line with Mike from It's Going Down. Mike and I have talked over the years. It's Going Down, if people don't know, is an anarchist news outlet based in the U.S., but with a reach all over the world. But I wanted to talk to Mike today, specifically looking ahead to, you know, the politics and organizing, especially grassroots, anti-capitalist, anti-colonial organizing in the U.S. So, Mike, welcome back to No Borders Media.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm glad to talk with you today about everything going on.
Yeah, and I wanted to start the show just by acknowledging a piece of sad news, and that's the passing of Clee Benally. On December 30th, just before the new year, Clee was an indigenous land defender, an anarchist, an artist, musician, author, based in the Southwest. He was a Diné. He was only 48 years old. There's a lot to say about Clee, but it's sad news. And as I was chatting with you before we got on, you know, before we started recording, I was mentioning how he's sort of a pillar of indigenous and indigenous anarchist organizing for the last couple of decades. It's stunning to think that he's not around anymore. I know you've interviewed him and you've paid close attention to Clee's organizing. Is there any thoughts you want to share?
Well, first and foremost, I would encourage people to check out the Indigenous Action website and also their Instagram. Right now, they're encouraging people to donate to Clee's family to cover different expenses. There's going to be, I know, a celebration of his life coming up soon. Also, people are encouraged to donate to various projects that Clee supported throughout his life, like the Hall No campaign. Indigenous Action is just an amazing project. That's going to continue. They put out a podcast. I would encourage people just to check that out and follow and support Clee's work. You know, it's definitely not over. There's just an amazing amount of stuff that Clee helped write and organize and put out, and it leaves us with this amazing legacy that hopefully we can all build upon. Just an amazing person. You know, one of the realest people you'll ever meet is what, you know, I feel like a lot of people that knew him really well have said. And it's true. And it's, you know, it's hard. I mean, we lost a lot of really good people this year. You know, obviously Tortuguita was, tragically and horribly assassinated by the state in the Woodlawny Forest in so-called Atlanta, Georgia, at the start of 2023. You know, there were two Food Not Bombs volunteers that were actually attacked by a right wing person in a truck that ran them over at a Food Not Bombs feeding. There, Jen Angel, who's like a longtime anarchist organizer and somebody that was involved in everything from Clamor Magazine to organizing the Bay Area Anarchist Book Fair, was tragically and horribly murdered this year. So we've lost a lot of good people, sadly. There was an anarchist actually from Ohio that died fighting in the Ukraine. So, you know, it's been a year of loss, but these people leave us with an amazing legacy to look back on for sure.
Absolutely. Klee had just published a new book that I feel it's worth highlighting. It's called No Spiritual Surrender, Indigenous Anarchy in Defense of the Sacred. And yeah, it's good to remind ourselves of the others that have passed on, and to build on their legacies. So yeah, let's talk about the year ahead of anti-fascist, anti-colonial, anti-capitalist struggle in the U.S. These are topics you cover and monitor at It's Going Down. You know, they're the big picture issues, and we'll definitely get into Trump and the upcoming election. But I feel like the inspiring stuff are the local struggles, you know, sometimes the hyper-local struggles where people are confronting these forms of oppression. So I guess just to start out with a general question, like what are some of those local struggles that you think we need to highlight and look out for in the upcoming year? I know looking back on the last year, Stop Cop City in Atlanta was something that definitely got a lot of attention worldwide. But, you know, you have your ear to the ground. What are some of these local struggles against fascism, against racism, against the attacks on queer and trans communities, and just other struggles that we need to keep our eye open for?
Yeah, over the past year, I mean, one of the biggest stories over 2023, of course, was the Stop Cop City movement. And I think it's really important for listeners to understand, if they've, you know, just been casually paying attention, just how much the murder by the state of Tortuguita in the Wilani Forest in January of 2023 just really galvanized this movement and just thrust it into the spotlight. And people across the world, and especially across the U.S., just, you know, really kind of gravitated towards this movement. And it really just took on a new kind of chapter in that struggle. It ceased to really become, I know this is like a movement slogan, but it really ceased to become like a so-called local struggle. And now, especially with, you know, the genocide and war going on in occupied Palestine, so many people have pointed out the connections between the Atlanta Police Department and the Israeli state, and just how the Israeli state is training or has trained Atlanta police along with other police departments over the years, and just how Cop City would just further entrench, you know, the state's ability to train police in counterinsurgency and anti-protest tactics that they've learned, you know, through the apartheid occupation of Palestine. But yeah, just, I mean, like, you know, one of the things to mention, I think that was really inspiring about this year was the amount of organizing that went into the Stop Cop City campaign. You know, there was a tour that hit the U.S. that was organized in various cities. You know, I believe over 70 cities had events. I know that people were thinking and kind of tabulating the amount of people that came out, and it was over 5,000, I believe. So there was a huge effort to, you know, really kind of organize not only local solidarity, but, you know, get the word out to people about what was going on in so-called Atlanta, and talk about just how that related to sort of the post George Floyd landscape, and how the state has really moved to just further militarize the police, further double down on this strategy of counterinsurgency and police militarization, you know, despite, you know, whatever kind of window dressings the Democrats, you know, decide to talk about how Black Lives Matter or whatever. And yeah, that we've just seen like an inspiring wave of weeks of action, solidarity actions. Most recently, there was a large march that was organized on the construction site that actually shut down construction. And there were several direct actions that took place that further have thrown a wrench into the gears of construction there. Kind of remains to be seen what the next moves are for the movement. I think people are definitely waiting to see what's going to happen with these people facing RICO charges. I think that's the other side of the coin, is that there's just been a massive wave of repression by the state. There's been an attempt to stop a referendum campaign that would get Cop City on the ballot there. And keep in mind, you know, Atlanta is, it bills itself as sort of the birthplace of the civil rights movement, you know, the home for protest, you know, it holds up civil disobedience as like this, you know, thing that's connected to the city. And to see the Democratic establishment then turn around and literally engage in a voter suppression campaign to stop people from voting on this project that a lot of people obviously are very vocally opposed to, I think just shows that, you know, both parties are willing to engage in these same tactics in order to stop this large coalition from, you know, hindering this counterinsurgency training facility from being built. So there's been just, yeah, lots of repression. People are facing RICO charges. You know, they've gone after bail funds. Tried to say that people arrested at, you know, a music festival were supporting terrorism. That came after a week of action, I believe in March, where there was also a large scale direct action that was not connected to the music festival where people were arrested at, that marched on the facility and people took direct action and some like property was destroyed and stuff like that. We're all kind of waiting to see what happens with that. And there's a solidarity campaign being organized right now around that. And we'll continue to talk with folks and cover that on itsgoingdown.org. And yeah, it will definitely be a major case. It will kind of show where the right to protest is at right now, currently.
The RICO charges are the racketeer influence and corrupt organizations. There's a state level one, and the one in Georgia is also being used against Trump, which is a bit of a mind fuck, I think. Where on the one hand, the prosecutor is using this against Trump and his alleged attempt to influence the election in Georgia, while at the same time it's being used against grassroots protesters and, you know, charging people for like buying paint and all kinds of other stuff. It really is an escalation. Is it fair to say this is an escalation that's rarely been seen aimed at this kind of organizing?
Yeah, I mean, I believe that there was attempts in the past to like use RICO against Greenpeace and other things like that. And those, you know, were obviously thrown out. It didn't work. And I believe RICO has been used against like far right anti-abortion activists in the past as well. So it's not without presence in the U.S., that these have been used against like protest groups, I guess. But I mean, the scale in which this is being used is very unprecedented. And like the scope of this, you know, like one of the major targets is like this bail fund. And I mean, again, like, you know, bail funds were central to the civil rights movement, bailing people out of jail. And they're trying to say that, you know, people using money for just like basic things like COVID tests is somehow a furtherance to some grand criminal conspiracy. And I think the other thing too is that at the heart of this, if you read the indictment, it really puts anarchism on trial. Essentially, it literally criminalizes mutual aid. You know, it says like, this is a movement that seeks to build a society outside of the framework of the state and capitalism, and therefore their use of mutual aid is a furtherance of this conspiracy to, you know, create this kind of world and movement. And I don't think you don't have to be a constitutional scholar to see as that's just an affront on basic rights. But also, you know, if that becomes, you know, essentially, you know, the go-to for the state. I mean, all protest movements, you know, are fundamentally, you know, threatened by that. So I think there's going to be a massive need to turn out in support of the folks facing these charges and to just, you know, call the state on its BS.
You know, as you mentioned, back during the George Floyd uprising, the three words defund the police became a bit of a mantra. And meanwhile, the state has, you know, engaged in massive funding of the cops and this militarization of the cops through things like Stop Cop City. Now, Stop Cop City, which you've just described, is something that's, you know, gotten a lot of attention. But there's also, you know, smaller scale attempts to build training facilities for paramilitary police and the rest of it. So could you talk about that a bit? I know you've covered it on the podcast in the past year, the more maybe lesser known examples of resistance to the continued militarization and, you know, building these training facilities for cops all over the U.S.
Yeah, there's, you know, for instance, there's a similar campaign in the Bay Area in against a cop training facility there. Other cities have similar type things in the works. You know, one of the things that happened following the George Floyd uprising is that there was a narrative that came out of, you know, both parties that defunding of the police happened and that there was a spike in crime and that therefore there needed to be more funding of the police. You know, I guess the other part of that is that police across the United States are having a real problem hiring more people than are leaving the force or retiring. They're, you know, I've hearing from various cities that they're having to kind of like either like increase the age of you know, for people to be police officers, or like for instance in LA, they're actually offering rental credit for cops if they join the force. So like they'll actually pay your rent or part of it to sort of entice people to join the force. One of the things that's happening, at least like within the media, is that there's this narrative that there's like a massive organized shoplifting gangs that are just, you know, looting and pillaging the retail economy and like shutting stores down, that cities are just ransacked by hordes of young organized shoplifting gangs comprised, of course, of youth of color. Which, I mean, in reality, there are like the economy, you know, one of the things that, you know, I wanted to say too, is that both parties have just been like touting. I mean, like if you listen to Trump, he'll talk about how good it was under him, how great the economy was going. And Biden will talk about, you know, how things are back to normal, you know, quote, after the pandemic, that, you know, the economy is doing so great. In reality, I mean, people are really struggling. Things are just as bad as they always were. People are working longer and longer hours. The economy has really tried to catch up from the pandemic, where people had a little more wiggle room and strikes were really pushing wages up and things were a little more in workers' favor. And now things have really, you know, with inflation have really, you know, hurt folks really hard. People are really struggling right now. Rents continue to go up. I know people are facing the same thing in so-called Canada. But I mean, if you listen to the politicians, it's just, you know, continuous blah, blah, blah about how great the economy is and how wonderful things are, which is not people's lived reality. And yeah, so there's just all this BS about, you know, organized crime and the other thing is like homeless encampments and stuff like that, which again is just like to divert people's, you know, understanding that like capitalism is creating these problems, but also things like, you know, like the so-called like retail gangs and stuff. Like there's been so many articles about how like corporations like Walgreens have literally just inflated these numbers and really lied about, you know, the amount of shoplifting that's happening, and actually the cause of a lot of retail stores going out of business. We wrote about this and it's going down not that long ago, but the cause of a lot of retail businesses going going under is it's post-pandemic. A lot of people are buying online. There's less foot traffic. People aren't shopping outside as much anymore. So a lot of places are just shuttering, and you know, the economy has definitely shifted. But there's an attempt to push this narrative that just, you know, crime and organized shoplifting is just, you know, out of control. And this is being pushed by both parties. I mean, if you look at a lot of the big, like, quote unquote blue liberal cities, like, they're pushing the same, you know, crime is just exploding, or also just like a tax on the houseless has been a huge thing this year, you know, on both, from both parties as well. And anarchists and other autonomous movements have responded to that by doing things like, pushing back against sweeps and doing eviction defense and stuff like that, which is really important. And I think we're just going to continue to see that into the next year. I think the Republicans are going to push fear of migrants, and the Democrats are going to continue to attack houseless people and the poor. One of the things we're seeing is that in the past year, a lot of the big cities, the blue, you know, Democratic controlled cities, have really come out against and really had this rightward shift. And you're seeing mayors really revert back to, and San Francisco is like a good example of this, with like the mayor, London Breed, reverting back to like drug war era policies and calling for more police, calling for more sweeps of houseless encampments, you know, as opposed to saying like, we need housing for people, we need social programs, you know, we need harm reduction programs. Yeah. And it's really just you know, we're seeing literally both parties, you know, this intense rightward shift.
Not surprising, a lot of what you're saying resonates for what's happening up here, you know, in terms of the cost of so-called cost of living crisis, the focus on shoplifting, but, you know, people facing inflation, facing really high prices, the increase of homelessness, the fact that encampments have emerged. This all resonates for what's happening here.
I think the other thing to point that out is that, you know, liberals love to talk about like QAnon and how there's so much disinformation. But I mean, I cannot tell you how many times I have had discussions with coworkers where they literally bring up this like trope of like, you know, organized shoplifting gangs, and that's what's causing the cities to decay, and that's why the stores are closing, and that's why there's so many homeless out there. I mean, literally, these are narratives being pushed on, you know, liberal or center left, you know, from like CNN, MSNBC, and are coming out of Democratic politicians. So I think that, you know, autonomous, anti-capitalist, anti-colonial movements really need to push back against these narratives and really push a politics of solidarity and mutual aid, and really also say that, like, look, like the same people that are having a crisis around rent have the same interests as the people that are houseless, that are trying to stop the sweeps, trying to stop the police from harassing them. Like, we all want housing. You know, we all want the same thing. We just need to stop them dividing from us and be able to push back and collectively engage in class combat against the people that are attacking us. And I think that's going to, the ability of movements to do that and articulate that through action and thought is going to be critical in 2024, especially as both parties are really going to push, you know, a rightward trajectory in the elections.
You mentioned how in San Francisco, the mayor there is reverting back to drug war style policies. And, you know, it's worth reminding our listeners that it was people like Biden and Clinton and others who in the 90s, in the early 2000s, you know, brought in laws that resulted in this incredible increase of people in prisons and, you know, the demonization of so-called welfare moms and what have you. And I mention all of that just as a prelude to the sort of the next topic I wanted to ask you about, which is resistance in prisons and people doing solidarity with folks in prisons. It's something I know that you cover consistently on It's Going Down. It's something it's important to cover in the U.S. context because you have over a million people in prison. The reason why there's so many in prison are because of these policies that basically criminalize people trying to survive. So maybe you could talk about that a bit, especially some of the prison resistance we should look out for or be aware of, which is almost always under the radar.
Yeah, you know, as we speak, there's two hunger strikes that we're aware of that are happening right now. I mean, there's just prisons in the U.S. and detention facilities and jails are just a constant side of struggle. I know, you know, one kind of focal point that we saw, I believe, was in St. Louis this year, where there was numerous revolts and uprisings there. People literally broke out windows during demonstrations inside and were able to talk with people outside. There's a hunger strike that's happening right now in the Pacific Northwest in the city of Tacoma, Washington, where people have been hunger striking for over 50 days. This is people that are incarcerated inside a migrant detention facility that's owned by the GEO Group, which is a private prison. There hasn't been this year, to our knowledge, something as large as like the prison strikes that happened in 2016 and 2018, or the statewide general strike that happened inside Georgia prisons last year. But I mean, there's just a constant stream of activity, of revolt. People are definitely organizing. There's various groups that are active in prison and sending stuff in and corresponding with folks. We just had a series of noise demos that happened over New Year's Eve that happened in across both the U.S. and so-called Canada and other places beyond that. But yeah, people are continuing to build those relationships on both sides of the prison walls, which is inspiring to see. And yeah, I mean, that's not going to stop anytime soon as long as there's people incarcerated.
One thing that resonated on both sides of the border were folks. I mean, we were obliged to organize in terms of defending drag queen shows, and there was, of course, the demonization of trans communities and trans folks. So could you talk about that a bit? It was something that the far right and the mainstream right and Christian fundamentalists essentially weaponized to the point where, you know, local libraries and local venues were being attacked and targeted by the far right, but also by mainstream conservatives. It's something that we had to organize and defend here on the Canadian side of the border, and it was done quite successfully. It was actually pretty inspiring to see people mobilizing, especially in smaller communities or, you know, more conservative communities. So could you talk about that aspect of the resistance and what we got to look out for in the upcoming year?
Yeah, I mean, very, very inspiring stuff. I mean, here in the U.S., it was very interesting around the same time that there was a bunch of stories coming out about, children being sexually abused in various Christian conservative organizations. You started to see this push to demonize pride events, drag queen story hour, which has been building for several years. White nationalist groups have been at the center of that, and also outlets like InfoWars, but this year it really hit its zenith. And you had sort of this coming together of, you know, far-right grifters online, various fascist, neo-Nazi, and white nationalist groups that were ready to be foot soldiers in that, groups like the Proud Boys, and a lot of, like, rank-and-file MAGA folks that were going out to things like school board meetings and demanding that books be banned, and that... Yeah, you had groups like Moms for Liberty, which currently right now is embroiled in a sex scandal. You had accounts like Libs of TikTok, which have really pushed this. The person behind that is a J6er. So there's sort of like all these various forces, ranging from, Fox News down to very small, extreme neo-Nazi groups that have all been involved in pushing this thing. And in the response, like you said, has really been inspiring. I mean, what I would say is that we saw like the third wave of anti-fascist action in the U.S. in recent years, the first being when Trump kind of entered the scene, the second being after Charlottesville, and the third being in response to this attack on queer and trans people. And obviously that's still ongoing. I don't think that's sort of kind of like aspect of the culture war here in the U.S. is going to go away anytime soon. But if the recent kind of elections are any indication, there's not much juice in this. I mean, it seems like most people actually prefer bodily autonomy and freedom and don't want the state to tell them what to read or who to love. And I think that us mobilizing in support of communities that are facing harassment is really great. And I think it's been inspiring, like you said, to see the amount of people that have come out. And also too, I mean, I think one of the things that we saw here in the US that was really interesting was that a lot of kind of liberals and progressives that before probably wouldn't have supported anarchist or anti-fascist organizing, I think really kind of saw the need for it. When you had neo-Nazis and Proud Boys showing up to things like Drag Story Hour events and Pride celebrations. I mean, we put out a lot of stories where people were reporting, you know, hearing things like, oh, the anarchists are here. Great. You know, they're here to help protect us and stuff like that. So that's, you know, that's an interesting dynamic. And I think something that the movements can build on, and it'll be interesting to see where that goes. We actually have an interview coming up with a group that's like in Southern California that's been organizing against far-right attempts to take over school boards and stuff like that, that actually describes itself as anti-fascist, but it's like made up of like moms and stuff, like, you know, people from the local community. So it'll be interesting to hear what they have to say. But yeah, I don't think this stuff is going to go away anytime soon. And the people that really pushed the trans crisis, so to speak, I mean, they're now pushing quote unquote decolonialization and attacking the demonstrations around Palestine. So that's going to be sort of their next pivot.
So Mike, I'm talking with Mike from It's Going Down. You mentioned how the same forces, the far right and even mainstream right forces that have focused on trans folks and attack drag queen story hours and what have you, or drag story time hours, are also now focusing on questioning the whole concept of decolonization. And they sort of lump everything in together, right? So you have decolonization, you have cultural Marxism, which is sort of an anti-Semitic trope that they use. They also talk about DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion. And, you know, for some of these things, especially DEI, I think a lot of us would have a critique of it in terms of liberal identity politics. But this is all lumped in together in terms of a cultural attack. And it's definitely escalated with in the post-October 7th environment with the explosion of pro-Palestinian protests, but also the attack on Palestinian organizing, the banning of groups like Students for Justice in Palestine, the equation of basic Palestinian liberation slogans like from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free, with anti-Semitism. On one level, like a lot of things, there's a lot of inspiring stuff, you know, huge actions, direct actions, focusing on the military-industrial complex. But on the other hand, this attack on pro-Palestine organizing that has really suffocated the ability for some of us to mobilize. So talk a bit about that. I know you've covered that on recent shows, including the weaponization of anti-Semitism. And when I say that, I do want to underline, I'm sure you agree, that anti-Semitism is a reality we need to confront. It exists. It's escalated in the past decade or so by the far right, but also by other forces. It's pernicious. It needs to be opposed. But when we talk about the weaponization of anti-Semitism, we're talking about it being used in a bad faith kind of way. So it's a huge question, but I think it's worth getting into for a bit. So share with us some of your thoughts on these topics.
Yeah, I mean, in the recent Republican debate in the lead up to the presidency, you know, where Trump wasn't there, Vivek Ramaswamy, one of the people that's in the running for the presidency, he openly embraced, and this is, I believe he's South Asian descent, he openly embraced the Great Replacement Theory by name. At a recent Turning Point USA event, I mean, they were doing the same thing. in Phoenix, Arizona. I mean, the Republican Party has embraced wholeheartedly the great replacement theory, or at least a version of it, you know, sort of as, you know, its core value. And I think that we're going to see over the next year them really just running with fear of refugees and migrants at the border. And they're going to attack. I mean, they're already doing it right now. They're going to attack Biden as sort of this, you know, open borders, you know, monster that wants to flood America with refugees to, you know, get votes to replace, quote, the real Americans. And it's, you know, as you said, you know, it's disgusting that they're then, I mean, basically what they're doing is they're, you know, they're taking the fear of the Black Lives Matter or Antifa rioter of 2020, and they're shifting that towards, oh, the universities are overrun with pro-Hamas, pro-terrorists, you know, Palestinian sympathizers, and all these people are just raving anti-Semites. But at the same time, these are the same people that are, you know, championing literally, like you said, outright anti-Semitic conspiracies like the Great Replacement Theory or cultural Marxism, which literally are based on the idea that Jewish elites are flooding the U.S. with immigrants and refugees, or that, you know, they're diluting, you know, like as Trump said, diluting the blood of the real people, obviously white people. I mean, you know, just to give you one example, the House Judiciary GOP on Twitter, I believe it was a year ago, they just tweeted three words, Kanye, Elon, Trump, you know, just sort of kind of like just as a statement, you know. And obviously these are all literally billionaires, but what do they all have in common? Well, it's anti-Semitism. I mean, Kanye over the last year literally went on InfoWars praising Hitler alongside Nick Fuentes, who is a neo-Nazi troll, marched in Charlottesville at the Unite the Right rally, had dinner with Trump, Elon Musk.
For Nick Fuentes, it's also worth mentioning that he at best minimizes the Holocaust, if not outright denies the Holocaust.
Oh, yeah, of course. I mean, and not only that, but I mean, recently on his show called for, you know, the outright execution of all Jews. You know, Elon Musk, literally as of late, has turned Twitter into this far-right cesspool and literally came out in support of the Great Replacement Theory and attacks on Jewish people and all of these anti-Semitic conspiracy theories that neo-Nazis and white nationalists have been pushing for years. So, and again, you know, I really want to stress, you know, over the past year, journalists and anti-fascist researchers especially have done a good job showing that a lot of these kind of low-level people associated with Nick Fuentes are in the white nationalist scene, although they've kind of left the streets. I mean, there are people that are associated with that movement that are staffers that are working with people like Paul Gosar, Marjorie Taylor Greene. You know, Ron DeSantis had a little bit of a scandal when one of his staffers made a campaign video for him that included a black sun. A black sun is like a neo-Nazi logo. It kind of looks like a swastika literally in the video. And then the campaign reshared it and then stated publicly that they knew that they were using that logo. So, I mean, again, like they're making inroads into the Republican Party. These are people that are, you know, working jobs, you know, for elected officials pushing this stuff. And like Ron DeSantis has been one of the most vocal claiming that he wants to literally ban all Palestinians from entering the country because, quote, they're all anti-Semites. So the same guy that has neo-Nazis on his staff that's making Black Sun videos to promote himself is then turning around and saying like, oh, I want to ban all Palestinians because they're anti. I mean, literally, like, this is the definition of gaslighting, you know, if anything. And like you said, yeah, it's this extreme weaponization of anti-Semitism against the Palestinian liberation movement, against people standing in solidarity with Palestine. But I think the good news is that really that kind of bludgeon or as like a anti-Zionist a Jewish person that we interviewed recently on the podcast said, that sort of scarlet letter, that is really kind of like coming apart, because there are large scale anti-Zionist Jewish organizations that are really central to a lot of the protests that are happening right now, that are in the streets. They're getting lots of support. And I don't think people are really buying this claim that if you don't support racist apartheid and the state of Israel's ongoing campaign of ethnic cleansing and genocide in occupied Palestine, that makes you an anti-Semite. I just don't think people are buying it as much anymore, at least. And, you know, it's created a huge problem for the Democrats. I mean, recent polls have shown that people that vote Democratic, or as we would say, like, don't vote for Republicans, 80% support a ceasefire and want the United States to basically stop arming Israel and want the war to end. And I think what that's doing on the left is creating a really interesting situation where very clearly there's a break and a distinction from, you know, the massive amounts of people that would just say, like, you know what, I don't like Trump, you know, I'll pull the lever for Biden and whatever. And the Democratic Party that's, you know, obviously has this keen interest in propping up Israel as this puppet regime in the Middle East to support its imperial ambitions. I mean, recently Biden was talking about how there needs to be, quote, a new world order, because the post-World War II new world order is coming apart. And there's these emerging camps, you know, anti-Western blocks that need to be kept in check, which is, you know, very scary. I mean, we live in a time of potentially World War III becoming very much a reality as, you know, Western powers are continuing to escalate and ramp up, you know, around this conflict and the Ukraine and Russia and China staging in the background. So, yeah, to go back to your question, you know, as horrible as it is, you know, what's going on in Palestine, I think it's one of the silver linings is the solidarity movement that's happening, that is very much embracing a diversity of tactics. It seems like there's been a massive outpouring of action. I mean, it's continued into the new year already. We're seeing people block airports. We're seeing sabotage actions. We're seeing campaigns against weapons manufacturers. There's all sorts of stuff that's been happening, and it doesn't seem to be dying down anytime soon. And it's been amazing to see both groups like the, you know, Palestinian youth movement and also anti-Zionist Jewish organizations like, you know, If Not Now and Jewish Voice for Peace, you know, really just, you know, push hard. And despite attacks by things like the ADL to call them anti-Semitic, or, you know, the Democratic Party, I mean, literally Biden's, you know, communications chief at a press briefing literally compared pro-Palestinian activists to the neo-Nazis who marched in Charlottesville. You know, I mean, like, I just don't think people are buying that. It's just, it's not landing, and it's causing a problem for the current regime. But I mean, obviously people are continuing to die and the war continues. And I mean, if Netanyahu's recent comments about, you know, wanting to just displace and continue to push out everybody living in Gaza, I mean, if that's their policy, I mean, we're going to just continue to see horrors unfold until we stop this thing.
That's a great overview. I mean, maybe just to give a quick anecdote that reinforces what you were saying, you know, groups like Students for Justice in Palestine or the Palestinian Youth Movement or Jewish Voice for Peace are being described as anti-Semitic. Meanwhile, Elon Musk tweets in support of the Great Replacement Theory, and he gets a visit to Israel with Netanyahu. Like, he's literally meeting with Netanyahu. And while the two others that came out of that tweet, you know, the Kanye, Elon, who was the third one there? Kanye, Elon, and...
Trump.
Trump, that's it. Meanwhile, Kanye and Nick Fuentes are having dinner with Trump. And Elise Stefanik, the Republican congresswoman who went after the university president, who I don't have so great sympathy for, but at the same time, she never denounced that in the same way that she's going over these university presidents for maybe, mumbling the words a bit about when you denounce genocide or not on campus or calls for genocide.
Yeah, there's a really interesting article that's in Vice that's talking about the Anti-Defamation League, which we've talked about on a recent podcast of ours with guests like Shane Burley, who's an anti-fascist and Jewish organizer and author. But I mean, you know, for instance, you brought up the Elon Musk thing. You know, the ADL originally condemned him for that, but then Elon then turned around and said, like, well, the real anti-Semitism is the people calling for decolonization. And then the ADL did a complete, 180 and saying, like, oh yeah, Elon's on the right track. And again, like you said, meeting with Netanyahu, which again tracks. I mean, the Israeli government has key links with far-right parties, literally, who include anti-Semites across the world. And this is not new. I mean, they had links with the apartheid regime of South Africa. So again, it just shows you that, the Israeli project can definitely stand in solidarity and link up with outright fascist and anti-Semitic formations, even as its defenders kind of like, put their aims against Jewish people in the streets, who are opposed to Zionism and in solidarity with Palestine. And I think that's, kind of one of the sick ironies of this thing, is that a lot of the people that are being targeted by this are young Jewish activists who are acting in solidarity with Palestine, being, targeted as quote anti-Semitic. And as people like Shane Burley pointed out on our podcast recently, one of the horrible things about this is this actually, dilutes and, the problem of real anti-Semitism, which, like, as you brought up, is the fact that, people like Elon Musk, Kanye West, Trump, literally billionaires and people within the Republican Party are pushing literally anti-Semitic conspiracy theories and linking up with street formations and movements that are neo-Nazi white nationalists and have aspirations literally of murdering and harming Jewish people on a mass scale. And that's something that we need to continue to call out and point to, as we continue to go forward.
And I guess the other dynamic to bring into this before we get into our last topic, which is just Trump, but is Christian Zionism, right? I mean, I think one reason why the U.S. has this disproportionate, completely out of whack support for Israel is, I mean, there's a lot of reasons, but one in particular is the Christian fundamentalists who exalt Israel, but at the same time, they do so because at the end times, Jews are either going to convert or be thrown into the sea. It's this out of whack idea of what it means to be supporting Jews or even Israel. It's really a stunning situation, but it's been around for a while, but it's been highlighted because of what happened in the aftermath of the October 7th terrorist attack by Hamas. So let's get into the literal elephant in the room, which is Trump. I think it's fair to say that the greatest enabler in our generation, or perhaps in the last 50 years, of racism and anti-Semitism and of horrible far-right ideas is Donald Trump. Whether he's president or not, he's enabled that. And he is on the verge of a comeback that will sort of vindicate him. All these indictments against him, all these criminal charges against him don't seem to harm him. He is competitive in terms of a general election. As you just mentioned, a lot of the weaknesses of the so-called alternative, the Democratic Party, in terms of them being pro-cop and demonizing people who are trying to just survive, their position on Palestine and Israel, all that served to do is sort of demotivate people. Now, I don't want to get all electoralist or anything, but clearly there's a difference between somebody who talks about immigrants poisoning the blood of the people and talking about African countries being shithole countries and Mexicans being rapists, and the alternative in terms of how that affects the social climate. So there's a lot there. it's not really sorted in my mind, but maybe share your thoughts about what we're going to expect in the next 11, 12 months as we come up to an election, and to what extent some of these grassroots dynamics that I've been talking about, grassroots resistance, will be affected by the fact that Trump is back as strong as ever, as far as I can see, and can very well win the election. And whether or not he wins or not, his movement or movements around him are going to be remobilized and enabled once again.
Yeah, I mean, you know, one thing I'll point out, though, is that, you know, Biden has really continued and expanded a lot of the, you know, attacks on refugees and asylum seekers, and just really continued a lot of Trump's policies along the border. They extended, you know, the COVID-19 protocols that white nationalists like Stephen Miller put in place, and then they actually changed that because they weren't draconian enough. But they've continued the stay in one country policy, in which borders to the south of the U.S. have militarized, and they basically tell people, like, if you come into this country trying to get into the United States, you have to apply for asylum here first before you can move on. So they've continued this policy of further militarizing, you know, the various borders. And they've, you know, started this really draconian, like, app program to have people apply, which, you know, there's still thousands of people literally waiting in Mexico. We did an interview with people in Tijuana that are organizing this ongoing mutual aid center there, and they talked a little bit about this. This is last year, about sort of those policies and how they're playing out. But I mean, they're basically just doing the same thing, you know, that Trump did. You know, one of the most horrific images we saw over the last year, I'm sure you remember this, is literally U.S. border guards beating people from Haiti with clubs, you know, on horseback. And so I just think that's important to point out, is that even though Trump has this extreme rhetoric and, you know, talks about literally shooting people at the border, at one point he wanted to put moats filled with alligators and snakes there to dissuade people from crossing. I mean, Biden is doing the exact same thing, but, you know, doing it much more quietly. I think that attacking so-called migrants and refugees is going to be central to 2024. I think that's going to be at the heart of what Trump is going to, like, campaign around. And I think we're going to see an extreme rightward shift by the Democrats around that, just in continuing the trajectory that they've been on. And I think it's up to social movements to articulate, you know, like, why are people being forced to do this in the first place? Like, why are they being pushed to take these, you know, massive, dangerous journeys in the first place? And, you know, we need to show solidarity with people that are being impacted by that, and they're not our enemies. You know, these are people that are in some of the most worst situations you can imagine, and they're trying to do anything they can to help themselves and their families. You know, another thing we could talk about too, and this is taking place in cities like New York, they're talking about, like, shutting down some of the few shelters that are there for people that are seeking asylum in the U.S. and refugees. So there's lots of mutual aid work that's going on in that, and solidarity with folks. One of the things that Republicans have done, if they've been taking people that are coming through at the border and putting them on buses and sending them to, quote, blue cities and Democratic strongholds and stuff like that. And we're seeing how the Democrats are reacting. They're talking about, you know, the migrant crisis, quote unquote, and shutting down shelters and stuff like that. And again, I think this is where social movements have a role to play in demanding, you know, housing for all, shelter for all. We need access for everybody, you know, for these things, and not allowing them to divide us. But like I said, I think we're just going to continue to see this being, like, a central theme in the election, especially on the right. And this is going to be a way for the Republican Party to basically point down and say, like, oh, all these problems you're having, all the rent problems, you know, your job, wages, all that stuff. It's really, it's their fault. It's not the people up above, it's the people below you. So, but yeah, like, will Trump win? This is something that we go back and forth on the show talking about. I would say some of my co-hosts would say it's not structurally possible for Trump to win. And their argument is that, you know, the coalition that he built hasn't gotten larger. I think the problem with that thinking, though, is that there's just a lot of people that maybe voted for Biden in 2020 that just are not going to feel it this time. You know, people are just hurting economically, and there might be enough people that stay home that Trump can squeeze out a win again. Or, you know, we'll be in a situation in which, you know, one of two things might happen. It might be so close that Trump could contest it, quote unquote, like he did last time, either through the courts or through, you know, some sort of far right maneuvering in the streets. Or we'll see it like go to the Supreme Court or something like that. Or we're going to see a situation like we're seeing right now, where more and more states are saying that they won't have Trump on the ballot. And we'll see this kind of situation emerge in which, you know, half the country says it's illegitimate this way, illegitimate that way. And the other half will say the opposite. And then, well, who do you believe, and who gets to decide? The Supreme Court. So we might be headed into a situation like that. Either way, yeah, I mean, I think it's obvious that Trump is going to be the Republican nominee. And Biden is not popular right now at all. I think large part because, it's just been more of the same. Things have not gotten better for poor and working people. They've just continued to get worse, and people are feeling it. And all this talk by the Democrats about how great Bidenomics is and how wonderful the economy is, I mean, that just makes people more upset and angry. And the Republicans are very good at creating enemies for people to rally around, whether it's drag performers, whether it's Antifa, whether it's Black Lives Matter activists, whether it's, you know, somebody trying to survive in a houseless encampment, whether it's refugees. You know, they're going to point to all these things. So it's like, these are your enemies. These are what's causing the problems. And, you know, the Democrats really are lock and step around, you know, those draconian policies as well. So what do they have to say about that? And again, like, regardless of how the election turns out, social movements, you know, need to be there to attack and critique and push against both of these narratives put out by the corporate parties.
I want to encourage listeners of No Borders Media to check out It's Going Down if you haven't already. It's the website, itsgoingdown.org. Honestly, you do an incredible job of covering grassroots struggles, not only in the U.S., but worldwide. But, you know, it's specifically with that focus in the U.S., the This Is America podcast does a great job of doing a deep look at grassroots struggles, hearing from people on the front lines, struggles that often don't get a lot of attention. It's intelligent, it's subversive, it's rebellious, and it's just good journalism. So I just wanted to commend you for that and encourage our listeners to check it out. And yeah, it'll be an interesting 2024, obviously, and maybe we should chat again closer or after the election and assess where this American fascism is at. Because you're right, we just have to acknowledge it's there, happening, and it's a matter of how we're resisting it and the different social factors at play in terms of resisting it. So yeah. Again, Mike, from It's Going Down, thanks for talking with us on No Borders Media.
Thank you.
That wraps up the January 2024 edition of No Borders Media. We were listening to an extended discussion with It's Going Down about the upcoming year in U.S. politics. No Borders Media is part of CKUT's Off the Hour at 90.3 FM in Montreal, www.ckut.ca on the web. We're grassroots community radio on the island of Montreal. No Borders Media, previously named No One Is Legal Radio, will be broadcasting regularly this year, the first Thursday of every month from 5 to 6 p.m., as part of Off the Hour, but also on our own podcasts and broadcasts. Check out No Borders Media on our social media, including Facebook, Instagram, Blue Sky, Threads, Twitter, Mastodon, for links, upcoming shows, and previous shows. No Borders Media shares and creates content in support of the struggles of oppressed peoples and in opposition to capitalism and colonialism. We'll be back live on Thursday, February 1st on CKUT's Off the Hour. Stay tuned for Upstage.
Good evening, it's 6 o'clock. You're listening to Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM and at CKUT.ca, the show about theater on the radio. From drama to musicals to burlesque to comedy and everything in between, professional, student, and community productions in and around Montreal, the island also known as Jojage in the Ganyagaha language and Muniang in Anishinaabe Mohan, where we spell theater with an R-E at the end. I'm your host, Sarah Day, recording from home on Thursday, January 4th, 2024. A very happy new year. I hope you had a restful and fun holiday break. For tonight's show, I will be revisiting some favorite conversations from the second half of 2023. My guests tonight include Yannick Truesdale, star of the hit TV show Gilmore Girls, who still lives part-time here in Montreal, how the Screen Actors Guild strike gave him a chance to appear on stage at Théâtre Jean Duceppe.
Something more natural with my personality and energy that I had to adapt for camera work, which I've learned obviously because I've been doing it for 35 years, but my personality and my energy is bigger than for camera. So on stage, I just feel kind of freer.
Another Canadian TV star favorite, Jake Epstein, who rose to fame as a teen on Degrassi, playing a troubled young man. He performed a solo musical show about his adventures in show business.